Hello, my name's Dave Emery. Welcome to the next segment of this series entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities. The title refers to a tactic of Nazis and white supremacists on both sides of the Atlantic of infiltrating the police and military in order to acquire specialized knowledge and abilities in order to effect the formal overthrow of democratic rule. We've been taking a look at organizational parallels and some possible operational connections between Nazis and white supremacists in Europe and their counterparts in the United States. Beyond that, I suspect there may very well be connecting links, and this is a suspicion, not a fact, but I suspect there may very well be connecting links between fascist elements in the government in this country and fascist elements in the paramilitary right, such as the fascist elements within the militias. I suspect the same is also true of European fascism as well, specifically fascism in Germany and in Austria, probably in France as well. We began by taking a look at the alleged killing. Well, there certainly was a killing of two black citizens in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where Fort Bragg is located. These killings allegedly committed by white supremacists within the U.S. Army. We have noted the possibility that those killings may have been committed to not only observe the death, the anniversary of the death of Robert J. Matthews, a member of the neo-Nazi organization The Order, but also perhaps to earn a spiderweb tattoo, which in some white supremacist circles is seen as an honor badge, a merit badge, which indicates one has killed for the cause. After that, we took a look at the Special Forces Underground, which literally appears to be an underground element of the very formidable Green Beret of the United States Army. This Green Beret Underground, or Special Forces Underground, is based at Fort Bragg and publishes a newsletter called The Resister. It remains to be seen exactly what political stripe these individuals are of. There is no firm indication, as far as I have seen, that they are Nazi or white supremacist. However, their newsletter, The Resister, is explicitly and overtly anti-democratic. So I think it is a reasonable question to ask under the circumstances, particularly given the superb and potentially devastating military abilities of the Special Forces. We've also taken a look at the offer made by the Special Forces Underground in a letter, in an issue, I should say, of the Resister, to train some of the militias and give them combat training for a confrontation with the government. After that, we began taking a look at the Oklahoma City bombing. Recall that the two people charged in that bombing so far, Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh, as well as Michael Fortier, the witness against them, were all members of the same military unit within the United States Army. Again, I think that raises the question about whether perhaps they belonged to a cell within the military. Again, specialized knowledge and abilities. As I've indicated, I think the political rhetoric on all sides in Oklahoma City is inadequate. I think that the Oklahoma City bombing was logistically far too complex to have been pulled off simply by two people. I think the nagging question of John Doe number two, who seems to have disappeared, plus the fact that although there was initial discussion of the connections between Nichols and McVeigh and the militias, those connections have been downplayed in the time since Oklahoma City has taken place. A High Times article from November of 1995, appropriately enough, entitled Militias, Enemy or Pawn of the State, raised the question about whether perhaps there was some kind of deal between the militias and the government, or I suspect that if it was not some kind of a deal, there is something about the relationship between some elements of the government and some elements of the militias that has warranted a journalistic and perhaps even a legal and national security cover-up. Again, despite all of the early coverage of the apparent connections between McVeigh and Nichols and the militias, this has dried up. And again, I think there has been no satisfactory explanation for the apparent disappearance from the face of creation of John Doe number two, whom the authorities are apparently no longer interested in looking for. Also, the possibility of a double blast, I think, warrants closer and more rigorous scrutiny than it has received. At the same time, the conspiracy crowd and the militias and so-called patriot networks themselves have dismissed the possibility that elements of the militias may have been involved in Oklahoma City. I think that analysis is premature. And the championing of Richard Wayne Snell, a white supremacist who, along with other people who figure in the milieu of the Oklahoma City investigation was involved in an earlier Nazi plot to blow up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Snell was executed on April 19th, and the Newsletter of the Militia of Montana from March issued a call to arms in order to help prevent the execution of Richard Wayne Snell. The championing of white supremacist cop killers, as well as the tactic espoused at a militia conference of tracking the time and rate of speed of Amtrak trains, this prior to the fatal derailment of an Amtrak train, allegedly by the sons of the Gestapo, I think gives the lie to the claim by the militias and the so-called Patriots networks that the militias themselves are free of guilt. Again, I think the militias are a mixed bag, incorporating sincere, although generally badly misinformed conservatives, as well as outright raving fascists and Nazis. And again, I've indicated my dissatisfaction with the political rhetoric on all sides, both from the government, the mainstream press, the so-called progressive sector, and the so-called alternative media, as well as from the militias, the so-called Patriots networks, and the conspiracy crowd. We took a look at, among other connections, the links between Richard Wayne Snell, one of the people accused in the alleged 1983 conspiracy to blow up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Richard Wayne Snell's body after his execution was claimed by Robert Millar, the head of a white supremacist compound in Oklahoma called Elohim City. Two of the security people for Elohim City were a fellow named James Ellison, who was the government's witness in the alleged 1983 conspiracy, as well as a fellow named Andy Strassmeyer, the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff. Andy Strassmeyer has been represented by Kirk Lyons, an attorney who is a frequent counsel for white supremacist elements. He was the attorney, for example, for Louis Beam in that alleged 1983 conspiracy. By the way, the government was unable to prove that case, largely as a result of the ineffectual quality of James Ellison as a witness. Note again some of the connecting links between people cropping up in connection with the 1983 plot and those whose names crop up in connection with the investigation into the milieu involved in the 1995 bombing. I want to indicate that those people are not necessarily involved in the bombing itself, and that's a point I want to emphasize. Nonetheless, I think that there may very well be some connections between the alleged 83 conspiracy and the milieu allegedly involved in that, and the 1995 conspiracy and the milieu that crops up in connection with that. By way of further underscoring some of the methodological considerations as well as methodological approaches as well as some of the possible organizational connections between Eurofascists and their American counterparts, I want to once again reread some sections of an article that has in many ways served as the key to this particular series. This is from the Searchlight magazine's issue of November of 1995. Subscription information about the Searchlight will follow at the end of this segment. This article, again, which I've excerpted a number of times, is called Werewolf or Paper Tiger, The State of Germany's Nazi Movement. It's by Andreas Fass, F-A-H-S, a German anti-fascist. And there are a number of operational or methodological similarities between Eurofascists and their American counterparts. SRA here refers to the Social Revolutionary Workers' Front, a German Nazi organization, and the head of that is Stefan Hupka. Skipping down in this article, we read, in Umbruck, the SRA's education bulletin for leaders, subleaders, and trusted activists, Stefan Hupka, a central SRA cadre, sets out clearly the dual strategy of the SRA involving infiltration of the state apparatus. Quote, known activists must get on with their normal political work, which is as necessary as ever. The others, however, should keep their distance from known rightist groups. They should not even identify themselves as nationalists. They should join the army and the police and see to it that they acquire specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote. The acquisition of this, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote, denotes the preparation of a new level of terror aimed not principally at foreigners and asylum seekers' hostels, but at, quote, politicians, journalists, intellectuals in various organizations who prove themselves stubbornly anti-national and pro-multicultural, unquote. What is set out here is essentially the, quote, strategy of tension, unquote, that has already begun in Austria with a series of Nazi letter bombings. Rieger, that's Jürgen Rieger, a German neo-Nazi attorney. Actually, I don't like the term neo-Nazi, a German Nazi attorney, about whom we shall have more to say later. Rieger pointed in this direction as early as 1992 when, in an interview with ARD Television, he proclaimed, quote, "When the first reporter is knocked over, when the first judge is rubbed out, then you will know it started," unquote. The political foundation for the NF organized werewolf organization is precisely this strategy of tension, according to which the bourgeois democratic state will be made to look weak and ineffective in the face of terror, coupled with the development of political and economic crises. It is a fact that this kind of strategy does lead towards the establishment of a strong state, whose attacks on democratic rights and increasingly repressive policies can be attributed to the need to react to such terror. The German Nazi terror onslaught of 1991-3, for example, enabled Helmut Kohl to toy publicly with the idea of introducing a state of emergency, which would have led to the curtailment of democratic rights. Similarly, the Austrian Nazi letter bomb campaigns have served above all to strengthen the electoral fascist Jörg Haider and his freedom movement, and have made their demands for the beefing up of the state apparatus and for increased spying on the population by the state a matter of public consensus. Indeed, I think that terrorism in the United States, including apparent right-wing and Nazi terror, such as Oklahoma City and the derailing of the Amtrak train in Arizona, that terror campaign also has spurred a campaign to pass a counterterrorism bill, which, if it were to have passed in its original form, would have gone a long way towards curtailing both legal and journalistic freedom in the United States. It would have been a draconian bill. As I speak, in mid-March of 1996, the House of Representatives has recently eliminated some of the most odious aspects of that particular bill. However, that by no means means that that bill is dead. We're going to reread a short section of the article that comprised much of the last two segments of this particular series. That article and research credit on this goes to a listener is from High Times Magazine of November of 1995. It's by Bill Weinberg. It's headlined, "The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State?" And skipping down to the last segment of this article, the article reads, "Speaking of the martial law contingency plans, which, by the way, would have included the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers and their use as federal agents, when the FEMA martial law plan was conceived, the domestic enemy being targeted was the Central American Solidarity Movement, and the plan was based on earlier ones such as Richard Nixon's Operation Garden Plot, which targeted the campus anti-war movement and black militants. However, in 1995, the Clinton administration is conveniently using the militia to justify beefing up the federal police state apparatus. The administration's anti-terrorist bill, written before the Oklahoma City blast and mostly aimed at foreign terrorist groups, would unleash special FBI powers against those suspected of supporting, quote, terrorism, unquote, further eroding the already besieged Bill of Rights. Americans in 1995 who were opposed to both fascist violence and police state measures, whether they come from Democrats or Republicans, are unfortunately being almost entirely left out of the political debate and had better find ways to act before it is too late." By the way, I personally, although Bill Clinton is certainly backing this anti-terrorism bill or counter-terrorism bill, and I am vigorously opposed to it, I do not view Bill Clinton as the demon he's been made out to be. I'm not a big fan of Bill Clinton's. If I were to describe him in a nutshell, I would describe Clinton in the same terms that von Bismarck used to describe Kaiser Wilhelm I. Von Bismarck said of the Kaiser, quote, "He is like a cushion. He always bears the imprint of the last A blank blank that sat on him." And I think that's a very good description of Bill Clinton. I do not view Bill Clinton as being in charge, beyond a nominal sense, of the federal intelligence and military apparatus. Rather, I think they are in charge of him. This is not to say that I hold a brief for the man necessarily, although I think when we see what follows Bill Clinton about 10 or 15 years down the line, I think Bill Clinton's going to look real, real good. There's an old expression, there's nothing like stepping in a cow flop to make you realize how nice tripping over a stone can be. And again, I want to note how Oklahoma City and other acts of right-wing and fascist, apparent right-wing and fascist terror have helped pave the way for a possible restriction or curtailment of democratic rights in this country. So far, the counterterrorism bill has been stymied largely as a result of lobbying efforts by a strange grouping of political bedfellows, the ACLU and the National Rifle Association. By the way, two organizations that I wholeheartedly support. I think the effect of the inveighing against the militias, and I think I've made my stance on them pretty clear, as well as the motion to restrict access to firearms, and I'm opposed to gun control, which I think is largely a red herring. It is not the source of crime, and it is not going to affect right-wing extremism. A friend of mine, by the way, had a bumper sticker made up: when guns are outlawed, only fascists will have guns. I think that's a pretty accurate statement. However, I think precisely because of the fact that the militia groups do have many sincere, although generally badly misinformed, conservatives in them, as well as some liberals, I think the strident rhetoric against the militias on the one hand, as well as the possibility of passing some truly draconian counter-terrorist legislation — for the time being that threat has been put on the back burner — I think the net effect of cracking down on the militias, passing a counter-terrorism bill, and the inadequate political rhetoric on all sides is going to be to achieve polarization and stratification. And I think those are the two key words here, and it would not surprise me if there were elements within the government that want to do exactly that. Recall, as we have seen in numerous archive shows, and I'll have more to say about those at the end of this segment, fascism is not something alien to the United States. It's not something alien to the corporate sector. It's not something alien to the political sector, and it's not something alien to the national security sector, and I have demonstrated that rather conclusively over the years. I think that the polarization and stratification process, which is inherent in the cracking down by the state on its citizens, is very likely to either drive the conservatives and liberals out of the militia movement — there are not very many liberals, but there are some — and to leave the field, so to speak, to the Nazi and fascist elements within the militias. This polarizing and stratifying tendency of a state crackdown against the strategy of tension was touched on in an article that was carried in the Christian Science Monitor of October 6th of 1995. Research credit on this, by the way, to a listener. This is an article by Sarah Chase, who contributes to Monitor Radio from Paris, and it's headlined, "France's Costly Anti-Terror War." And this is talking about a crackdown on the Islamic extremists who have apparently been behind a series of train bombings in France and other terrorist bombings. The article reads in part, "In Paris alone, several hundred thousand random or not-so-random identity checks have been conducted in the past 2 months. For example, at the Châtelet subway station, the hub of the commuter rail system, two freshly mobilized gendarmes approach a group of friends who've met at the station to trade football cards. The officers pull aside the only North African-looking man in the group. Instead of handing his papers to him for verification, they drop them on the ground. This is not police brutality or excessive use of force, but it sparked the indignation of seven people who were not predisposed against the security measures. The action converted potential allies of law enforcement measures into opponents who on some level began to sympathize with Kelkal. This is invariably what happens when a wartime mentality is applied to groups within society, be they Muslims in France or African Americans or even Branch Davidians in the United States." Indeed, and I think that may be precisely the goal of those elements that are deliberately producing some of these terrorist incidents. And again, I think that those elements in all probability involve some elements within the government and some elements within the militias and or paramilitary right in general. My feeling is that what we are witnessing with the militia movement is something whose significance has largely escaped much of the journalistic community, both mainstream and so-called alternative. It is my considered opinion that what we are witnessing in the United States is something of a rerun of the Conservativo Revolution, which took place in Weimar, Germany. That was a right-wing philosophical political movement whose most militant elements constituted the so-called National Bolsheviks. By the way, this has nothing to do with communism. National Bolshevism is intended here in the same context as the National Socialists or Nazis. Turning again to the Stefan or the Andreas Foss article from the Searchlight that we excerpted a minute ago, the social revolutionary aspect of the Conservativa Revolution or Conservative Revolution is described here and is described as being ideologically similar to many of the Nazi groups currently active in Germany. Returning to the searchlight of November of 1995, ideologically, the Gemeinschaft and above all the SRA, which is based in East Germany, hark back to the fascist national revolutionary tradition during the pre-Hitler Weimar Republic, with its mixture of radical nationalism and anti-capitalist, anti-system sloganeering. This form of anti-capitalism is utterly reactionary and focuses on only certain aspects of capitalist development, such as monopolization, internationalization, and the role of finance capital. These aspects, they link frequently but not always with anti-Semitic propaganda about, quote, Jewish capital, unquote. From the standpoint of the Nazis, in a situation of increasing social crisis and a future economic crisis, the objective and subjective conditions for broadly based nationalist and racist, quote, social protest from the right, unquote, are well and truly imaginable. In the November 1995 article from High Times, we noted that in the anti-environmental aspects of the militia movement, specifically the county rule and wise use movements, those elements of the militias and the milieu surrounding them that have been attempting to free up a number of different counties in the West from federal regulations have enjoyed the support from political figures who either have been or are active on the right wing of the Republican Party. Again, this was discussed in the anti-environmental section dealing with the militias. Former Reagan staffers and people associated with James Watt, Ronald Reagan's anti-environmentalist Secretary of the Interior, have been involved with some of the elements that within the militia movement that have been anti-environmental in their orientation. And again, I think the article from High Times asking the question about whether the militias are the enemy or pawn of the state raises a very, very good question. Just as I don't think we can speak of the militias, so too I don't think we can speak of the government. There are many different aspects of the government, and I think that the Nazi and fascist elements within the militias, as well as the anti-environmental elements that overlap the militias, the county rule and wise use movements, are indeed right in step with and in effect represent an extension of the right wing of the Republican Party and the anti-environmental thrust of Newt Gingrich's contract with America, I think, is completely in step with those particular elements of the militia movement. Indeed, in the series that I did about Jörg Haider, I pointed out that just as in Weimar Republic there was the Conservativa Revolution, so too in the United States we have the Conservative Revolution of Newt Gingrich and company. And also I would note that Jörg Haider has talked about his movement as a conservative revolution. We're going to deal with the Conservative Revolution and with the Conservativa Revolution in Weimar Germany and the National Bolshevists in our next segment. I alluded earlier to the archive shows. Those are a form of radio documentary that I put together over the years in which the printed sources upon which my lines of argument are based are excerpted on the air, literally read on the air, so that listeners can tape the programs and use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. All of those archive shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication service.
All of Dave Emery's archive shows are available from a tape duplication service named Archives on Audio. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is 415-346-1840. Again, Archives on Audio can be reached at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, 94117-0023. The phone number, 415-346-1840. There is also a catalog available which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each show, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. The Archives on Audio catalog is available on the KFJC webpage, which is reached at http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emery. Again, the website, all lowercase letters, is http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emery. cygnus.com/kfjc/emory. The website also has a suggested reading list and a list of other sources to pursue for more information on this field of research.
Indeed, and also you heard me referring to the Searchlight magazine, a British anti-fascist publication that I frequently use on this program. More information about that right now.
To subscribe to the Searchlight, a British anti-fascist publication, write to Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, or phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax 011-4471-284-4410. That's the Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax at 011-4471-284-4410.
That again for subscription information for the Searchlight magazine. Those of you who are looking for book titles in this field of research are referred to Antifa Book Search Service. More about that right now.
You can contact the Antifa Book Service at 945 Taravelle Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116. They specialize in books about fascism, the intelligence community, and clandestine power politics. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC gets money from this arrangement. Again, that's ANTIFA Book Service, located at 945 Taravelle Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116.
And again, neither myself nor the station gets any money out of this arrangement. In our next segment, we're going to be comparing the relationship between elements of the militia movement and the right wing of the Republican Party, which I think in many ways is parallel to the relationship on the one hand between Nazis and white supremacists in this country and the right wing of the Republican Party, and between their counterparts in Europe and the right wing elements of Jörg Haider's inappropriately named Freedom Party, as well as Helmut Kohl's CDU-CSU. By the way, Andy Strassmeyer, an acquaintance of McVeigh and former security person for Elohim City, the son of Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff. However, the Conservativa Revolution, the conservative revolution, is our next focus. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.